This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We often hear about this information age that we're living in, and about the unprecedented amount of knowledge and information that is available to us, but this is actually just as much a disinformation age as it is an information age. The sobering reality is that the torrent of messages we encounter in books, tweets, articles, TV broadcasts, and Facebook videos are very often propaganda serving a political agenda. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller will be on the show today to tell us about this trend and about his new article called Welcome to the Disinformation Age. In our second segment, we're going to talk about a man who is sometimes called the Vladimir Putin of the Middle East. This is a man who is the heir apparent of the Middle East's largest country, Saudi Arabia, and he's already ruling with an authoritarian style that has some very significant implications for the country and the region. Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadidwe has written a powerful article on this man for our most recent Philadelphia Trumpet print edition, which is all about strongmen around the world. And Anthony has some really fascinating analysis to tell us about the Saudi prince's strongman style rule and how it aligns with Bible prophecy. In our third segment today, we're going to go in a different direction and discuss the state of Christianity in Britain. There was a poll taken of people in the UK who identify as Christians, and some of the findings of this poll were troubling. Trumpet writer Dennis Leap will tell us about these findings and what they indicate about British Christianity, and he'll zero in on the Ten Commandments, which were one of the main topics of this poll, and he'll talk about whether they still have any relevance today. And to wrap up the show today, I want to tell you about some ancient words of wisdom that are full of timeless value, and it's value that can help each one of us to make better decisions and judgments pretty much every day. All of this on today's Trumpet Hour. Well, the information age is well underway. Much of the world is shifting quickly away from the traditional activity and commerce that was brought about by the Industrial Revolution and moving toward economies and societies based on knowledge and information. Information is everywhere, and it's accessible to a degree that it never really has been before. And there are countless benefits that come from this shift and from this information age, but there are also plenty of hazards that come along with it. One of these is the unprecedented ease with which revisionist powers can disseminate propaganda and other disinformation. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller in the studio with us today. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So could you please start off just by telling us a little about some of the history of disinformation and propaganda and whether or not this is actually a brand new phenomenon?
Well, definitely disinformation and propaganda is not a brand new phenomenon. It's almost as old as human civilization itself, with some of even our oldest records in the Bible talking about different ways that rival nations would try to deceive their enemies or deceive the nations they were fighting against. In the book of Joshua, there's an example of a tribe that dressed up in ratty clothes and smeared dirt on their face and actually went to the Israelites and told them that they had come from a very far country and tried to make a peace deal with them, even though God had told them in the book of Judges, don't make a peace deal with the inhabitants of Canaan. And this tribe, though, successfully deceived Joshua, making them believe that they were from far away, and actually did enter in a peace deal without fighting at all, just due to the fact of what their clothing and their appearance, and basically spreading ancient Canaanite fake news.
Wow.
They were from just around the river bend, not from some distant land.
Right.
And that was back around like 1500, maybe a little after that, B.C.,
yes.
And then about 1,000 years later, in a very different part of the world, in China, you had the famed military strategist Sun Shu, who wrote his book, The Art of War, where he went through all sorts of techniques that rival generals and rival emperors and rival kings could use in their fights against each other, with one of his more famous sayings from that book being, "Supreme excellence consists of breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting." And it's basically what he's saying there is that this has been a technique that these kings and emperors in China were using from long before that, where if you had to fight, you had to fight. But it, in his view, it was better to actually find like some sort of propaganda or disinformation campaign that could get your enemy to do what you wanted them to do without actually having to go to battle.
Yeah, I guess the primary goal with competing powers is not so much to be able to military dominate the other, you know, the enemy power, but just to be able to have your way. And if you can accomplish that just by influencing them with ideas or ideology instead of having to lose lives and spend treasure in a conflict, then seems like that would be to anyone's advantage.
Right. Or even if that doesn't work, there's more modern examples of nations that have even used disinformation or propaganda as part of the fight.
Okay.
I'm trying to think the example that probably springs right to mind right now as you go back like Franco-Prussian wartime with Otto von Bismarck in Germany, where he'd actually like forged a letter from the ambassador of Germany insulting the ambassador of France, and then forged another letter from the ambassador of France insulting a ambassador from Germany, and basically prompted a conflict between Germany and France off two fake letters insulting each other's ambassador. But his point was, in that case, he was actually wanting this conflict, but he wanted the conflict to happen sooner rather than later. He thought it was inevitable, and because he knew Germany had the military advantage and France was catching up, and so you use some propaganda, some disinformation, some fake news to kind of get that ball rolling. Germany came out in a much more favorable position by the end of the Franco-Prussian War than they may have if it would have happened in a later time.
So it sounds like in these ancient examples, it was mostly the leadership of nations that would be targeted with disinformation and propaganda in order to try to steer the nation. But in this modern trend, it seems like there's the opportunity to target entire populations. Is that right?
Right, because in Sun Tzu's time or even Otto von Bismarck's time, you are relying mostly on a fake letter sent to one person, and you better make sure that that fake letter made it into the hands of the one person who could actually make a difference. It would have been very costly for Prussia to print however many million pamphlets to give it to every individual in France.
Right. Most of whom would have probably been illiterate anyway.
Right. So it wouldn't have even done any good.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have even done any good if you would have done the pamphlets. And there are examples of later wars of people dropping pamphlets from planes to try to spread propaganda. Mm-hmm. But now with the only in the past, less than 30 years, with the rise of the internet, and even more recently with the rise of social media, you've got platforms like Facebook, you've got platforms like Twitter, and a plethora of other social media sites. It is possible to distribute a message to huge swaths of a nation, and there's been examples of governments who've really realized the potential of this and start using social media and internet things to spread messages to their rival nations or even allied nations to influence public opinion in their favor.
Andrew has an article up on thetrumpet.com right now called "Welcome to the Disinformation Age." And in your article there, Andrew, you give a really fascinating and really a sobering example of some angry protests that erupted in Texas recently, where it sounds like entirely the result of Russian disinformation. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Actually, in the article, I'm quoting a piece that was published in The Atlantic on November 27th by Amy Zeigart. She's a co-director for the Center for International Security and Cooperation. And this article of hers is entitled, "The Tools of Espionage Are Going Mainstream." And she's making the points that some of these tools that used to be reserved for, like, spy agencies to use against rival spy agencies or rival policymakers because of the increase in technology. You can do just as I was describing a moment ago and target entire population bases. Russia is one of the nations really at the forefront of this art. And there's quite a bit of political debate these days at how effective these efforts have been.
Yes.
But both sides of the political spectrum here in the United States, very few people would deny that there is an internet research agency in Russia, which is a private firm that receives state funding, that really specializes at writing social media posts and targeting them to particular population and demographic groups in rival nations to advance the Kremlin's goals.
Right.
And the one example you mentioned here is where this internet research agency, they actually established two Facebook groups. Mm-hmm. And the one Facebook group was called Heart of Texas, and it really specialized on catering to those who have fears of like Sharia law or Islamic infiltration of the United States.
Traditional Americans that want to keep America as traditional as it could be.
Right. Traditional Americans who are really worried about some of the terrorist problems you see in other nations spreading here.
Yes.
But then the same Russian group established a completely different Facebook group titled Save Islamic Knowledge, which did the exact opposite thing as the first Facebook group and just really promoted how beneficial Islam is to American culture.
Hmm.
And both of these two groups did pretty well. They both got about a quarter of a million followers on Facebook.
Wow.
But then they this was on May 21st last year, 2016. This Russian agency that was running Facebook accounts organized a protest outside a certain Islamic center in Houston, Texas. Same day, same place, same time. And so you had this very anti-Sharia, traditional American culture group protesting the spread of some of these Islamic ideas into the United States.
Yeah.
At the same time that you had this group of American Muslims protesting for the spread of these Islamic ideas.
And yes.
So it didn't actually break into what you'd call a riot, but there were definitely a lot of angry Americans in the streets protesting and holding signs and screaming at each other because there's this agency in Russia that organized two counter protests for the same time in the same place.
That is really fascinating. So it looks like these organic protests and divisions just, you know, organically happening in America. But if you pull back the curtain, this is all the result of Russian manipulation.
Right.
The,
and
the
some
fact
of the,
that these two groups
some
decided
of the
to meet
social
it.
Trends that were the concerns about the spread of Islamic ideas in the United States on the one side and the advocacy for Islamic ideas in the United States on the other side are organically grown, but the fact of like getting these people into two Facebook groups and then organizing a protest
yes.
for same dime, same place, that's all Russian instigated.
Well, it really does seem like a brilliant way to, well, for the Russians to find existing divisions that already exist in America and then working to exploit those divides and deepen them and just widen the rifts between various, you know, demographic groups there in the U.S. Have there been any other concrete examples of foreign meddling in the U.S. that causes actual conflict here domestically?
That's probably one of the most famous ones. I mean, there has definitely been, I think, with the whole like NFL take a knee protest with mm-hmm. these NFL players who are taking a knee to during the national anthem and not participating in the national anthem because they believe, or it's a protest against what they call alleged police brutality.
Right.
And there's definitely guess about like maybe 3,000 Facebook posts from the same internet agency in Russia. Senator James Langford from here in Oklahoma was writing about that recently, a Republican senator who's saying that this they've caught Russia making posts specifically targeted to Black Lives Matter activists saying that you are being unjustly killed by police. And posts to like your traditional white working class NFL fan talking about how this Black Lives Matter movement and this these NFL protests are unpatriotic and un-American, and they're disrespecting the flag and they're disrespecting the anthem. And so it does, in one way, it does kind of debunk some of the political rhetoric you'll hear about Russia trying to influence things in favor of the Republicans, or even Russia trying to influence things in favor of the Democrats, and that you've got some of these agencies being funded by the Kremlin who are spreading fake news for both sides to do just as you described, just try to exacerbate social divides and cause domestic turmoil in the U.S. because the more domestic turmoil is, the less the United States is likely to interfere in Russian incursions into Ukraine or the Baltics or someplace that's far away.
Well, that is really interesting. Could you place this trend of just increasing disinformation in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Right, and as I brought out in that disinformation, Welcome to the Disinformation Age article, there is actually a prophecy in the book of Daniel, chapter 12, verse 4 in particular, which says, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." And so this is a concrete prophecy that knowledge is going to be increased dramatically when you get to the end time. And now we touched on this a little bit earlier in this interview, but you have stuff called like the knowledge doubling curve that was put together by U.S. architect Buckminster Fuller, who estimated that for most of human history, knowledge doubled once a century. Mm-hmm. Since World War II, it started doubling once every 25 years. Today, they think it's doubling once every 13 months, basically once a year.
Wow.
And it's projected with some of these internet technologies that it may get to the point where knowledge is doubling every 12 hours. And so once it gets to that point, you're actually getting like an increase in human knowledge every day equivalent to what was once take 2 centuries.
That is astounding.
A dramatic increase in knowledge that's really a huge proof that you're at the time that Daniel was talking about when he said knowledge would be increased. We have basically our flagship book here at the trumpet.com is Mystery of the Ages. This is Herbert W. Armstrong's kind of like capstone book that's describing like the 7 great mysteries that every human being needs to understand. And the 4th one's actually the mystery of civilization. And he has a quote from that book where he says, "We now live in the biblical prophecy areas called the last days. This is the last generation before the coming of Christ to rule and accomplish on earth what mankind should have done. In these last days, according to Bible prophecy, knowledge, spiritual as well as material, shall be increased."
Yeah, well, that's some very insightful analysis there, Andrew. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the age of disinformation that the world is now in the midst of. Please go to thetrumpet.com to read Andrew's powerful article on this topic. It's called Welcome to the Age of Disinformation. And please also check out Mystery of the Ages while you're there. Just click on the literature tab, and there's an entire chapter in Mystery of the Ages about the mystery of civilization that Andrew just discussed there. And Andrew, we really appreciate you keeping us apprised of these developments and just helping us to see the significance of it. So thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
If you take a look at the Middle East today, there is somewhat suddenly a new and very influential mover and shaker on the scene. Because of his strong-arm tactics, this man is sometimes nicknamed the Putin of the Middle East. And trumpet writer Anthony Chibadidwe has written a powerful article about this man for our latest print edition. The latest issue is all about the increase in authoritarian rule around the world and about a return by numerous nations to that kind of leadership and governance. And Anthony's article in that issue is called Mohammed bin Salman, Putin of the Mideast. And you can find that article on thetrumpet.com right now. And Anthony is in the studio with us today to tell us about what Prince Salman's rule means for Saudi Arabia, for the Middle East, and for the world. Thanks for coming on the show today, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
So to start off, could you maybe just bring us up to speed on who this prince is and when he came into power and what sorts of behaviors he's been engaged in that have brought him onto your radar?
I'm glad that you mentioned that he is a prince. You emphasize that he's a prince because, yes, that's what he is. He's not yet the king, and yet he's already acting like a king in Saudi Arabia. His father, King Salman, is the king. He came in power in 2015, right. And when he came into power, he made his son, Mohammed bin Salman, the deputy crown prince. And he also made him the defense minister of Saudi Arabia, and he has used the power that was vested in him. He has used it to really make Saudi Arabia great again, so to speak, and to consolidate his own power.
Okay, and so what sorts of things has he done so far to consolidate his power, even though he's only in the prince position?
When he started off as the defense minister, he was very inexperienced. A lot of people emphasized that about him. He came up with this coalition of Arab nations that were supposed to fight terrorists. That was their main goal and their main principle. And a lot of people attacked him, criticized him. They mocked that alliance. Because it was so vague, its mission was vague. It was just to fight terrorism. A lot of people just said he's so inexperienced, and this is just a good example of his inexperience. But he also came up with another coalition that went into Yemen to fight the Houthi rebels who had just taken over the capital of Yemen. And these Houthi rebels are sponsored by Iran. So Mohammed bin Salman, this deputy crown prince, who was also the defense minister, is the one who led that effort to go after the Houthi rebels sponsored by Iran in Yemen. And that war has been going on ever since. And in fact, it's a huge disaster right now. The United Nations considers it the worst humanitarian crisis in the whole world because the Saudi Arabian coalition is attacking the Houthis, but it's also attacking civilians in the process. The Houthis are doing the same thing. They're attacking the Saudi coalition and killing civilians in the process. So it's a huge disaster. And Saudi Arabia has come under a lot of pressure. So has the Houthis, but Saudi Arabia has come under a lot of pressure for this war. A lot of its partners have said that they will reduce their assistance to Saudi Arabia because of the civilian casualties. But Saudi Arabia has stood its ground. It's still fighting in Yemen. And I think a lot of that has to do with this strong man who's effectively ruling Saudi Arabia.
There was recently a really high-profile assassination that was a part of that the Yemen conflict there. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yes, that's a very important point that you bring out. The Houthis, they were allied to the ex-president of Yemen. And just over the weekend, I believe, the Houthis assassinated him. They assassinated someone who once was their ally, but reports have been saying that he was talking about defecting to the other side, the Saudi Arabian side. In fact, he was killed as he was about to flee to Saudi Arabia, according to reports.
And this is the president?
Ex-president of Yemen.
Okay.
But he was allied with the Houthis.
Right.
So he decided, well, I think it's probably time to switch sides, I suppose because of just understanding how
ruthless the Houthis have been, and Iran, he was considering switching allegiance, and he was assassinated for that. So it just shows really what's going on in the Middle East, and it also shows the power and the influence that Saudi Arabia is exerting in that country.
There was also a missile attack recently that was apparently fired by the Iran-sponsored Houthis, and it was fired at the Saudi Arabian capital of Riyadh. What can you tell us about this attack and about what Prince Salman's role in that might have been?
The reason why the Houthis are attacking Saudi Arabia this much is because Saudi Arabia is showing itself strong in the Middle East, especially in trying to fight Iranian influence. And of course, that has meant attacking the Houthis as well. So the Houthis are firing back. The fact that the Houthis are attacking Saudi Arabia in this manner, they targeted the international airport in Saudi Arabia's capital, which is a civilian target.
Yeah.
So that shows how much they want to fight Saudi Arabia. So they did. They fired this missile. Saudi Arabia says that they intercepted that missile. But recent news have indicated that maybe they didn't even intercept that missile. That missile actually did hit the international airport, and probably the Saudi Arabians didn't want that news to go out because it exposes their vulnerabilities. But at any rate, the Saudi Arabians have been attacked by the Houthis, who are sponsored by Iran. And their response to that attack was that Iran, this is an act of war from Iran against Saudi Arabia. And of course, the prince, again, is leading those efforts. He made those statements about Iran's act of war against them. So you're seeing this continued escalation of this proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And it continues because Saudi Arabia does have a strong man who's really willing to give Iran a fight.
So do you think that a case could be made that Prince Salman's being on the scene and emerging as a strongman-style ruler, that that this could widen the rift between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
It certainly is the case, because Iran is the number one terrorist sponsoring nation in the whole world. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you need a strong man to confront another strong man.
Yeah.
So that's what we're seeing in the Middle East. And I think that the Saudi Arabians just realized that we just have to do it. If civilians are killed in the process of trying to fight Iranians, well, that's too bad. That's unfortunate, but we cannot stop the war just because of that. Whether it's deliberate or not, that's another story. But this war has been going on, and it doesn't seem like it's stopping anytime soon.
Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us, and especially the end time trends and prophecies that the trumpet is watching?
There's one prophecy that really stands out, and that prophecy is, we've talked about it a lot, it's called the Psalm 83 prophecy. Mm-hmm. It's about an alliance that forms, and Saudi Arabia is part of that alliance. And we have seen over the years, ever since Saudi Arabia became the big power that it is in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia has been leading a lot of alliances in the Middle East. Think about the Gulf Cooperation Council. Think about the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Saudi Arabia has been leading these alliances. And the Bible does talk about this alliance that has Saudi Arabia in it. And it's one of those alliances that need a strong man, and we can see that Bin Salman is one of those strong men who can help fulfill this prophecy of an alliance that's also has ties to Germany.
Yes.
So that's one prophecy that we can see being fulfilled by this strong man.
And for any listeners who would like to learn more about the Psalm 83 prophecy and other prophecies that relate to the Middle East, what literature would you recommend?
I'd recommend The King of the South. It's a booklet that was written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, and it discusses Iran, it discusses Saudi Arabia in the context of Bible prophecy, and it does get into the Psalm 83 alliance, and I recommend our readers to and listeners to download that book or request a free copy.
And Anthony has also written a concise but a really packed article about this powerful new Saudi Arabian leader. Anthony's article is called Mohammed bin Salman, Putin of the Mideast, and you can find that article on our website, thetrumpet.com, right now. You can also go to thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab, and you'll be able to find Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's booklet, The King of the South, there, which really takes a deep dive, as Anthony said, into these scriptures and just shows how they are being fulfilled in the current events that we see now happening in the Middle East. So please stop by thetrumpet.com and check those out. Anthony, thank you very much for bringing us up to speed on this development.
Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Well, the YouGov market research and data analytics firm recently conducted a poll of British individuals. And part of this poll zeroed in on those who identify as adherents of Christianity. And Trumpet writer Dennis Leap has written a really hard-hitting article about some of the findings of this poll and just what it reveals about the state of Christianity in the United Kingdom right now. KPCG listeners will recognize Mr. Leap's captivating voice from the excellent show that he hosts called Just the Best Literature. And his article on this topic is up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called The Ten Commandments Are More Relevant Than Ever. And Mr. Leap is here in the studio today to talk with us about his article. Thank you for being here, Mr. Leap.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always great to come into the Trumpet Hour.
Yeah, well, maybe first you could just fill us in a little bit on the details of this poll, what exactly they found about those who identify as Christians in the UK.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, this did come out, the article that I originally got in contact with was from the Telegraph. So the poll was obviously maybe shocking enough that even the Telegraph, wanted to talk about it.
Right.
So what's really interesting though is not to cast any disparaging light on the Telegraph. I don't think they could really understand it, let's say from a Christian perspective,
yes,
like maybe we could. What I thought was so fascinating is that the YouGov poll, when it talked to Christians, these are professing Christians, they said that four of the Ten Commandments they considered irrelevant.
Wow! So four out of ten,
no use for them. But then they liked six of them.
So which four did they think were irrelevant, and which six did they like?
Well, what's really kind of funny is it's not really funny. In fact, it's really kind of tragic, but that's just an expression. But what was amazing to me was the first four that are irrelevant are the first four of the Ten Commandments.
Hmm.
And they are, I'll just give you the short version but the four that they considered irrelevant were, you shall have no other gods before me. That's the first commandment. Second one is, you shall not worship any graven image. Third one, you shall not take God's name in vain. And fourth one was, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So yeah, those were the four that people feel are irrelevant.
Right.
Now, the six that they liked were, and this is really, again, it shouldn't be funny. It's interesting. They still believed that it was wrong to disobey your mother and father. They still believed it was wrong to commit adultery.
Mm-hmm.
They still believed it was wrong to lie. They believed it was wrong to steal. They believed it was wrong to commit murder. And they believed it was wrong to covet.
Okay. So it's really the those that pertain more to man's relationship with man.
Right.
That they feel were relevant. But those that are about man's relationship with God, it seems that they think those don't have relevance.
Exactly. And that's where anybody who really studies the Bible, you know, that Christ, when he was teaching, of course, the religious elite of his day didn't like his message. Right. So they're always trying to trip him up. And there's this big scene in the book of Matthew where he just put them to shame on a certain doctrine. And he said, look, don't you read the Bible? And of course, they got really, really, well, were really upset about it. And so they sent a lawyer in and they said, well, to Christ, what's the greatest commandment in the law?
Yeah.
And so essentially what he did, he said, there's more than one great commandment. There's actually two great commandments. And he says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul.
Yes.
And then the second one is you should love your neighbor as yourself. Now, essentially what he was doing was he was covering all 10 commandments, but he broke it into the two great commandments. And the first four of the 10 commandments deal with love towards God. The last six deal with love towards, well, your wife, your family, and your neighbor.
So in those two great commandments, the first one would have basically encapsulated the first four commandments.
Exactly.
And then the second great commandment would have encapsulated the last six of them.
So essentially all these Christians out there saying they could care less about God, but they really like their fellow man.
Wow. You know?
So that's what's really, I think that was even shocking probably to the Telegraph.
That is really interesting. It shows that there is an appreciation for practicality that you can maybe immediately see the fruits of and the benefits of, but there's an absence of any sort of appreciation for spiritual, more spiritual law that maybe it's difficult to see the immediate value of it in your own life. That's strange.
Yeah, it's what the thing that I think is really, really shocking about all of this is how, let's say, religion in both, let's say, Britain and America is declining. I mean, we know there's so many stories from World War One and World War Two, especially World War Two. They just, you know, just the movie Dunkirk came out, and mm-hmm. you know, a lot of Britons would have prayed to God at that time to save all of those soldiers that were, you know, stuck and could have been slaughtered, and we know that Britain even called for days of prayer, days of fasting at that time.
Yeah.
And so surely at one time, Britain really was more focused on the first four, let's say, because you needed God.
Right.
And now, majority of Britons say, well, God's kind of irrelevant. We don't need to worry about God anymore. But, well, let's make sure we don't kill each other, steal from each other, lie to each other, covet each other's goods.
Yeah.
You know, let's not commit adultery. So here we are in this very dangerous world, and it is getting more dangerous all the time. And I think what's really serious and what motivated me to write this article was we need God more now than ever than we did before. Yes. And not that we shouldn't also, you know, love our neighbor, you know, not commit adultery, which is a big problem in Britain.
Sure.
You know, we shouldn't kill. It's a big problem in Britain. Certainly, it's a big problem in America as well. You know, we shouldn't steal. Well, people are stealing all the time. And so in some ways, really, they're saying all these six commandments are good. But really, if we're honest about it, they're not really observing those anyway. You know, the majority of people aren't doing that. So.
That's true. Yeah. In your article, you share a really interesting experience that you had recently watching a Broadway show type production about the story of Moses and just about the way the Ten Commandments were handled in that production. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't want to necessarily cast any disparaging, you know, comments on the organization that did it. So I kind of didn't say where it was, but it's
right.
It's a very big production. It's in a very famous vacation spot, you know, in Missouri. I can say that much about it. But we had heard about this production for several years, and being involved in literature and certainly involved with Shakespeare, you know, I just really like to go see theatrical events, and so I do love the story of Moses. I've actually written quite a bit about it over the years. And so the whole play is about Moses, and it was absolutely spectacular. The stage settings were unbelievable. You're really in a, it was, it was like the way the stage is set up, it's set up in three sections. They had live animals on the stage. I mean, so when Moses is a shepherd, there's actually lambs and sheep running through the aisles. You know, when he was leaving Egypt, there was this chariots on the stage with real horses, and they were driving, the pharaohs around. I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah.
And so it's, I mean, you really got a feeling, you felt bad for, his mom who had to give him up. I mean, they even were able to portray the river and the little basket in the river, and, the parting of the Red Sea was amazing. I mean, this was all live action done on a stage.
And sounds really impressive.
It's a massive theater.
Yeah.
And so I was actually thinking, well, this is actually, pretty good until Moses gets the Ten Commandments. Now, if you've ever seen Cecil B. DeMille's movie, The Ten Commandments, they did kind of borrow from that. So here, this character of Moses, he's up on the mountain, and they have God's voice talking, and they have this, like, looks like there's flames when God's writing the Ten Commandments down. And I know this was all done by a Christian organization, and I was a little hesitant to even go, because I'm wondering what are they really going to teach here? So Moses gets the Ten Commandments, he takes them off the mountain, immediately drops to his knees and says, "Oh God, this law is so holy, we're never going to be able to keep it." and so I'm going, oh, here it comes. But then on the middle of the stage, which you weren't really aware of, because it was kind of like off stage left, there's this figure coming in with this hood and this long rope, and he's got a shepherd's staff. And when Moses says, "Oh, this law is so holy," this voice of God comes out and says, "Moses, I know." He actually says, "I know it's holy.
I know that it's not even any use for you to try to keep it,"
right,
basically.
Yeah, so I just wasted all my time with all these effects and giving you this law.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he says, "But Moses, don't worry. My son Jesus is going to come, and he's going to write laws in people's hearts," which is, that is scriptural.
Right.
But basically, you got the impression Jesus Christ is taking care of all this. He's going to keep the law. You don't have to worry about it. And then the lights come on in center stage, and it's the typical view of Christ. It's this long-haired guy, the shepherd, and all these little sheep are running around on the stage, and it all looks very, very great, and everyone could be happy. And then there was an altar call. Yeah.
Really, yeah, right there in the middle of the play.
Yeah, they actually asked, if you want to give your life to Jesus, you can come up, on stage and all that.
Wow.
That's when I wanted to actually run out of the theater, but I couldn't escape the crowds, so. But anyway, it's dispensationalism is what it is.
Yes.
And that's it. For all of you out there that don't know what that is, that's just the feeling that there's been seven dispensations in the Bible. And at the time of Moses was one dispensation, and the Ten Commandments were appropriate for that time, but you no longer need the Ten Commandments now, because we're in the dispensation of the gospel. And so the gospel is what's most important.
So that experience really shows the way most modern Christians probably perceive the law. It's not possible to keep it, so there's not much use in even trying.
Right.
But that's not actually a biblical view of the Ten Commandments.
Not at all. I mean, if you understand true Christianity, I mean, God does bring people to Christ. I mean, that's scriptural. God does expect us to repent. I mean, that's very scriptural.
Yes.
He expects us to repent of our sin. But then God gives us, it says very clearly, he gives us the Holy Spirit so we can keep the law. And so not that we're going to be perfect at that. We're going to have to struggle with that all of our lives. But you can keep the law. And, it's something really a child can understand. I mean, so.
Your article ends with a very impacting section that's subtitled, "Freedom Comes by Obedience." I wonder if you'd mind just summarizing the main points that you make in that section for us.
Well, if you look at even the book of Hebrews talks about Moses. And I mean, Moses obviously was a man of faith. Moses obviously, Christ is the one that gave him the law. If you really understand what the Bible says, it was Christ that was delivering the law to him. And so he even says in the book of Hebrews that Moses, you know, saw being with Christ greater riches than Egypt, and that's why he made the break that he made. And the thing is Christ's whole purpose is, well, it's to deliver people from slavery. And we know, even in the book of Hebrews, it says that Egypt is a type of sin. And so here Christ does, he's still working to deliver, well, his people today from slavery to sin. And sin and Egypt are really synonymous in many ways. And so why would Christ do away with the Ten Commandments? That's what dispensationalists believe. Christ did away with the Ten Commandments, but how could he do with something that was actually given to the ancient Israelites so they'd stay out of Egypt? You know, it's right. Crazy. And so the thing is here, I mean, if you look at the prophecies about America and Britain just going back historically, you know, ancient Israel went into slavery. They were taken into captivity, and basically because they didn't keep the first four commandments.
Yes.
I mean, they did not obey God. They did not keep his Sabbath. They had idols. And God says, okay, you're going into captivity. Judah, the same thing. They're going into captivity. And so here we have two nations who were the greatest nations on earth, the United States and Britain, and we're full of idolatry. And we don't keep a Sabbath. I mean, Sunday is not the seventh-day Sabbath. And so, well, really, we're facing captivity. You know, if you really look at the Bible the way we should, it's one package. It's not divided into seven dispensations.
and you're not really permitted to pick and choose which commandments you think
No. And so do we expect to keep our freedoms if we're not obeying those Ten Commandments? It would be silly to think that we can maintain our free societies that we have and not keep the laws of God.
Yes. We've been talking with trumpet writer Mr. Dennis Leap, who has written an article about this YouGov poll and about this trend and just about the ongoing value of the Ten Commandments. The article is called "The Ten Commandments Are More Relevant Than Ever." It's a very powerful piece, and you can find that on thetrumpet.com right now. Mr. Leap, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. Look forward to coming back.
It's time for today's last word.
There are some words of wisdom that were written down some 3,000 years ago. And so these are obviously ancient words, but their relevance has not deteriorated at all throughout the ages. They actually remain every bit as relevant today and as pertinent and valuable as when they were written. And it could even be argued that in this age of information and disinformation that we discussed a little earlier in the show, that these words are even more applicable than they've been before in some ways. These words are recorded in Proverbs 18 and verse 17 in the Bible. And they say, "He that is first in his own cause seems just, but his neighbor comes and searches him." It's a little difficult to understand what exactly this means in the language of the King James Version of the Bible. But if you imagine for a moment that you are the sheriff of a small town, and one of the town's residents, let's say his name is Stanley, visits you, and Stanley says, "Hey, Sheriff, my neighbor Paul, he just chopped down a big oak tree that was growing on my property, and then he sold the lumber from it, and he kept the profits for himself." So in this scenario, what would you think? Would you think that Paul had done wrong to Stanley? Would you think that Paul had committed an injustice against Stanley by tampering with his property and then profiting from it? Would you think that by the powers vested in you by the state of Oklahoma or wherever you may live, that you should arrest Paul? After hearing Stanley's account of that tree, those would all be natural conclusions to arrive at. But this proverb, Proverbs 18:17, says that we need to be cautious when we are judging a situation like this. This proverb says that we should not make up our minds about a matter if we've only heard one person's side of the story. It's very easy for us to hear one side of a dispute and to then think that we know who's right and who's wrong. When we hear that one person's side of it, that person usually tells it in a way that makes him sound like he's right. The person that speaks first seems just. But if we hear the other side of the story, the other person's version of things, then we might realize that the first person wasn't revealing everything. Or we might realize that the first person to speak was presenting the facts in a way that distorted the truth or omitted some important details. Proverbs 18:17 once again says, "He that is first in his own cause seems just, but then his neighbor comes and searches him." He that speaks first to try and defend himself in his own cause seems just. King Solomon wrote this proverb, from what we can tell, and he's saying that it's important to hear the other person's side because the other side of the story will search the first person's account of the story. And if you look at that word search, there are several Bible translations, such as the International Standard Version and the New International Version, that render the word cross-examine. And I think that using cross-examine here makes this proverb more clear. We usually hear about cross-examination in the context of courtrooms and trials. That's what happens after one side of a court case calls a witness to the stand, and then the other side wants to talk to that same witness to check his credibility and maybe to find problems with his testimony. So they cross-examine that witness. So let's return to our hypothetical situation. If you were that sheriff who had heard Stanley accuse Paul of chopping down his tree, then what we should do next, if we follow the wisdom of Proverbs 18:17, is to reserve judgment for a moment until we hear Paul's side of the story. So if you were that sheriff, you might talk to Paul and say, "Hey, your neighbor Stanley said you chopped down his tree and then you sold the wood and kept the money. Is that true?" So imagine that you ask Paul about it and he says, "Yes, I did chop that tree down. I had told Stanley that the tree was endangering my home. It hung over my house, and since parts of it were dead, it was only a matter of time before a gust of wind blew it over. A couple of its branches had already fallen onto my roof. And so I told Stanley that it was dangerous because it could damage my house, and it could maybe even injure one of my family members. So I asked him to chop it down, and he refused. For over a year, I politely asked him and waited patiently, but he always refused to do anything about it. So I finally told him that I would chop it down myself. He didn't object to that, so I felled it, and I milled it into lumber, and I sold the lumber for $1,000. And, Sheriff, what Stanley may not have told you is that several years ago, I did some major repair work to the road that he and I both drive on, and I have paperwork right here showing that he actually owes me more than $1,000 for that work that I did. So last week, I told him I would keep the $1,000 from the lumber from his tree, and we would call it even on the debt from that road." So there's Paul's side. There's Paul's side of the story. And suddenly Paul doesn't appear guilty and malicious like he did before. And suddenly Stanley does not appear to be a hapless victim the way he tried to portray himself as being before. Stanley seemed just at first, but then Paul's side of the story searched him. It cross-examined him. And it revealed that Stanley was not accurately explaining what had happened. So this proverb just shows how vitally important it is for us to hear both sides. And I think this proverb is a valuable one for all of us to think about because it can help us to have better judgment. In Matthew 23, verse 23, in that scripture, Christ says judgment is one of the weightier matters of the law. He says the weightier matters of the law are faith, mercy, and judgment. It's a really short list. Just three things, and judgment is one of them. So this shows us that having sound judgment is hugely important. It's one of the foundational things that makes a person stable and dependable and happy. Mr. Gerald Fleury is the host of the Key of David program here on KPCG-FM, and in one of his recent episodes, he spoke about judgment, and he said, quote, "You have to make judgments about just about everything in life. and you have to weigh the evidence and then try to make a sound judgment. That's the way our minds work. You get all the evidence you can, and you try to make a sound judgment or a good judgment if you're doing it the right way. End quote. So sound judgment is one of the most important virtues a person can develop. The absence of it can lead to all kinds of calamity in our lives, but the presence of it can help us to live stable lives and to bring stability and joy into the lives of others. It is a rare virtue, but it's one worth striving to develop and to develop more of. And one of the surest ways to do that is by following the admonition of Proverbs 18:17. If we're trying to mediate an argument between two people, we should be sure that we hear both sides before deciding who's right and wrong. And we can also apply this sometimes even when we're reading the news in this age of information and disinformation. For certain complex topics, we may need to hear both sides of the argument before we really know what the truth is. So in all of these matters and in all kinds of other situations, it's wise for us to follow the words that God inspired Solomon to write. It's wise for us to hear both sides of a matter before we pass judgment. I'm Jeremiah Jacques. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Thank you for listening today. Feel free to send us your thoughts and questions about the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I'd like to thank our guests today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, and Mr. Dennis Leap. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with this thought from Ernest Hemingway. There's nothing noble in being superior to your fellow man. True nobility is being superior to your former self. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.